reading sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the End of Fin Show,
a smooth talk of the town.
Cool. Yeah. Yes, you are listening to the Andy Fin Show, and today is Monday, May 21st in the year 2007. And on this day, in 1934, a city in Iowa became the first city in the United States to fingerprint all of its citizens.
The city is?
Well, it's Oskaloosa.
Of course it is.
But what's bizarre, it doesn't matter which city it is so much as I can't believe that there was any city that was fingerprinting all of its citizens in 1934. I mean, what was the occasion? Not like we had a lot of terrorism.
Really?
I wouldn't have thought. We had the Great Depression.
It was that.
But in any case, I just thought that was interesting that they were fingerprinting people back then. Because, of course, now civil liberties and this kind of... Like, if any city right now said we want to fingerprint everybody, I don't think Americans would stand for it. But I didn't think we'd ever stand for a national ID card. And they're talking about the possibility. There were any number of Republicans in the first Republican debate saying they were for an ID card. When Chris Matthews tried to get them to clarify, they backed off a little. I don't know how many of them clarified in the end. But I still think they think they're going to have an ID card.
Well, you know what else is fascinating?
No, I do not.
On this day, Peter Jackson and Jim Corbett fought for 61 rounds only to end in a draw. And this is not the same Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings.
And that would have been what year?
King Kong. Oh, the year is 1891.
Yeah, that's going back a ways. A lot of my listeners aren't going to remember that, as old as they are.
But you mentioned Plato.
That's true, but Play-Doh didn't come out until the 1950s.
Play-Doh.
Yeah, Play-Doh was when I mentioned Play-Doh's birthday, that was...
I thought it was Plato.
No. Play-Doh was invented in 427 B.C., according to my records here.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about something else that was in the news this past week, and
what?
That is that a train left South Korea at 9 a.m., traveling at 50 miles an hour.
Is this an SAT question?
Exactly. No, a train went from South Korea into North Korea, and a train went from North Korea into South Korea. And it was an exchange, not a frank exchange of views, as their leaders often have. It was an agreement to allow some families who have been separated for more than 50 years, since the Korean War ended in 53, and it ought to allow them to get back together.
Aww.
Now, I was in South Korea in the year 2000, and I went to the demilitarized zone. And, you know, if you ever saw MASH, I saw Wee Jambu.
Never saw MASH.
Okay, that's right. You've told me that once.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. What kind of a depraved childhood did you lead?
My parents were cruel.
That is cruel. How could you? I don't see how you can have a television in the house and not see an episode of MASH.
Better yet, I have five TVs.
They're on all the time, though.
No.
Anyway, Wee Jambu and all these other little towns are actually there in South Korea. So I took a trip to the demilitarized zone, and you get to look through binoculars across at the commies on the other side. And just like Reagan did when he went there, just like Bush 41 did, Bush 43, Clinton, every president goes to the demilitarized zone and gets a picture taken in fatigues, looking tough, looking across at the commies.
Awesome.
It is awesome. But what's interesting was I also visited the town where they built this train station in South Korea. They built this train station to share families and allow families from the north to come visit people in the south, people from the south to go to the north and see long-lost relatives.
Yeah.
You know, 50 years, a lot of your relatives are dead in the course of 50 years.
Aww.
Especially when the life expectancy isn't 75 or 80. And I guarantee you the life expectancy of North Korea is nowhere near what it is here. It's not as bad as Sierra Leone, but it could be close.
Oh, no.
In any case, they've now done this exchange. So there's a couple of good things could come out of that. One is that the more contact the North has with the South, the better it is for democracy, the free enterprise system, and those of us that care about truth, justice, and the Armenian way.
I care about that.
See?
Including the Armenian way.
And because the North Koreans have such a sheltered existence, you know, they have this militaristic attitude because they have been told all their lives that the rest of the world is against them and they must fight the evil United States and other Western powers that wish to do them harm. And, of course, we don't want to do them any harm. We just want to bring them Mickey Mouse.
Of course. And, I love Mickey Mouse.
And McDonald's. And Walmart. Did you know there's a Walmart and a Circuit City, I think it is, that are planning to open in Baghdad?
Are you kidding me? I know everything.
Okay, then you knew that.
No.
Okay, then. Well, anyway, we won't get into that whole situation. But back to this, it has to be good news if people from the South get to know people from the North and vice versa, because that means that they're going to see that the South has it pretty good. I mean, everybody's got a cell phone welded to their ear now in South Korea. It's
welded.
I think it's a law. Well, it's welded with flesh, so it's really a soft weld of sorts.
Still
but,
hurt.
Well, they're moving to implants, but they didn't have them ready in time when the law was passed.
Man.
In any case, the other thing about this that's worth telling the story is, while I was there, I was traveling with a, went on this weekend. I'm sorry, went on this day trip with a friend.
Significant other?
No, it's just it was the wife of a friend, but everything was on the up and up.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But while we were there, a group of children from the rural countryside, I have to believe, but maybe just because all Koreans have black hair, this group of children... No, they do.
No, yes, I believe you.
This group of young children, about five or six, came up to me, and the friend I was with, and she had blonde hair, and I have white hair, as you know, and a white beard.
Yeah.
And they came up and surrounded me, and they took my hands, and I was immediately suspicious. They were only between the ages of 5 and 8, and cute little kids, but I was just worried that they were going to distract me and pickpocket my wallet or something. I couldn't imagine why they were coming over to this stranger. I think of them as shy, you know. Mm-hmm. And they took both my hands, and they wanted to talk, and they were joking and laughing. And it turns out, what I figured out once I made sure my wallet was still there, mm-hmm. was that they were fascinated with non-black hair. They had apparently not seen enough of it.
They
that
came to the
they
right
were
person.
Terribly excited, and they were excited about my white hair, and they were excited about her blonde hair.
That's something to be excited about.
It sure is. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is what happens to Korean people when they get old? Doesn't their hair turn white like ours?
Well, apparently not.
I'm trying to think. I know I saw older Korean people. But their hair
just falls out.
No, I think it's a salt and pepper kind of a look. They must keep a lot of black hair. You know, maybe Ronald Reagan was part Korean because he went to his grave with hair pitch black and he swore he never dyed it.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's the story of the DMZ. A riveting story. I mean, just riveting.
Riveting.
Now, there's another interesting story in the news, and perhaps you have something you can contribute to this issue. Oh, don't sell yourself short. That's my job. This family ended up with a monthly cell phone bill of $1,100.
Yes.
And the reason was?
I don't know.
Text messaging.
Oh.
They were being charged 10
Why
cents.
Why parents just get unlimited?
Well, good question. So they were on a plan where the text messaging was 10 cents a message. The daughter didn't know it. And they give you 100 text messages, and after that, they charge you 10 cents each. Well, turns out she spends about 100 a day.
Yikers.
And actually, maybe it was 15 cents each because she ran up a huge bill. And maybe they have brothers and sisters, too, that did text messaging. In any case, she's now working in the family business for the summer to pay off the excess cell phone stuff. And I think
family business?
I think they're in the mafia or something.
Sweet.
But they went to another plan, I'm sure. But it turns out that this is a common problem. We are now sending 158 billion text messages nationwide.
Excellent.
Now, I don't know if you know the history of text messaging.
Oh, I most certainly do not.
Well, I happen to, so I'll tell you a little bit of it.
That's great.
It started in Europe. Now, we had instant messaging here, but long before we had, semi-long before we had instant messaging here, and of course, instant messaging is done from people's home computers. When people say instant messaging, they usually mean doing it from my home computer. Or a computer, rather than, it could be a wireless deal, but rather than a phone. And then when they say text messaging, they mean from the phone, typically mm-hmm. in this country. In Europe, they call it SMS, short message service. And what happened was, when cell phones caught on earlier in Europe than they did here, for a couple of reasons, the main one being pricing, they don't charge for incoming cell calls. Or, you know, we get charged for incoming and outgoing.
Mm-hmm.
They do it the way we do our home phone service. You know, you get charged for the calls you make, not the calls that come in. They only charge at one end. Here, they charge at both ends for the
right.
calls. So that was one reason why cell phones caught on first. But when it came to text messaging, what happened was they set up a structure where you could, for every minute of airtime you had, you could send, I think in some countries it was 10 text messages. So kids were given a prepaid cell phone. Maybe the parents would give them $30 a month or whatever they'd give them. And they could talk for 30 minutes or they could send 300 text messages. So what would they choose to do? They all started sending text messages. Now, the phone companies in Europe never expected text messaging to amount to much of an application. They figured, who's going to do this? If you got a phone, you'll just call people. But because these kids were limited in their budget, they switched to text messaging, and they started using their opposable thumb and flashing out, hitting those little keys.
I feel like more and more people are going to get carpal tunnel syndrome.
Well, I think that's very possible because of the quick action on the thumb. Although now they're putting full keyboards on some of these
exactly,
phones.
Exactly, those Sidekicks.
Right.
They're the hip new thing.
What we'll go to is voice input, so you can say the letters that you want taken into the thing. That's kind of the ultimate ridiculous interface.
So do you text message to your friends?
I don't use text messaging much. I have a message come in occasionally from a friend, and I will text message back.
What would you say, K?
It depends what they asked.
Hypothetically, what would they ask?
Hey, big boy, you got time for me? Things like that.
Ugh, I just got a really disturbing picture.
I understand. Well, you asked. You shouldn't ask, should you?
I shouldn't ask.
So I get an occasional text message, and I never know what to say.
Yeah. I taught my parents how to text message. Only my mom caught on.
That sounds dangerous.
Why is it dangerous?
I'm just making
conversation. Not dangerous at all.
In any case, so it caught on in Europe first, and they were sending billions of messages when we were sending only a few thousand, I'm sure. And now it's caught on here, and it's causing people big bills, but they'll solve this pricing problem someday. We don't know when. Maybe not soon. Maybe soon.
Not soon.
Not soon enough, shall we say that. In any case, when we come back, and this break is going to be very short, we're going to move on to the world of politics and catch up with a little bit of what's happened this week. And, frankly, what should have happened.
And I am begging you to listen to my show at www.andyfinn.us.
The Andy Finn Show. Uncommon talk radio.
It's so uncommon, we're back without advertisements.
That was the shortest break ever.
There's been shorter. But you just haven't been around that long, you know. You're a youngster.
It's true.
Back in 427 BC, I believe, we had a Play-Doh break, and then we couldn't find the Play-Toh, and so we went right back to the show. This was back, we were using...
Did you know that rhymed?
Tin cans. Well, I think I did. And speaking of tin cans, today, again, is May 21st. And on this day, in 1906... Lewis Pearlman received his patent for the demountable tire-carrying rim.
Woohoo!
I think I know what that means. It means you could actually, your tires weren't vulcanized to your, didn't you like that word?
Yeah.
Vulcanized to your rims.
That would involve knowing what it meant.
So the vulcanization of rubber is the process that allowed us to have inflatable tires, this hard, heavy rubber. Until then, rubber was like balloons and prophylactic type materials.
I'm sorry, listeners. I'm not as smart as you.
Well, my listeners may not know either, so it's always good to have...
No, they probably do. Aren't you?
No, you're sitting here. You're
IQ of a billion trillion.
You're the canary in the coal mine for us here,
being
you know?
I love being the simpleton.
Tweet, tweet.
Yay.
Anyway, as somebody who grew up in a garage and injured my hand more than once on demountable tire rim machines, I just thought it was interesting that they invented that as far back as 1906.
Wow.
Also, bicycles were first seen in the United States on this date.
Great.
In New York City. And I want you to think about the year out there, listeners, because I'm going to tell you in a minute, but I want you to guess in your head. Nobody will know that you're right or wrong. How early would we have had bicycles first introduced to the streets of America?
427?
427 B.C. No, not quite. But, by the way, they were originally known as swift walkers, right? Now, you know how it is, that the horseless carriage, we didn't know what to call automobile, so they called it after what came before, the horseless carriage. So swift walkers was what they called this because they didn't know what to call a bicycle. In any case, it was 1819.
Who got it right out there?
Somebody must have.
Joe Smith, I knew it was you.
Somebody must have. Anyway, let us move on. And let's talk for a minute about a couple of things that happened in the news. One of which is Jerry Falwell. So Jerry Falwell left us this last week. And I don't really want to spend a lot of time on Jerry himself. I really want to say more about the aftermath, because it's been really interesting how people have dealt with his death. People may know out there that Jerry Falwell is a religious fundamentalist who founded Liberty University. I don't know if he founded Liberty College and then University. I think he did, but he certainly made it big and famous.
He really did.
And he founded the Moral Majority. He was one of the original, along with Pat Robertson, one of the original political leaders, or one of the religious leaders who got into politics. And he changed politics in America. He also changed how we deal with religion in this country. And he changed the Republican Party, because the Republican Party now has a religious wing. Now, what was interesting was how the right and the left argued over Falwell. The left got out there and said, oh, it couldn't happen soon enough to suit me. They weren't very charitable, some on the left. I was pretty charitable, just because I'm not a vindictive kind of a guy, and I think everybody has a contribution to make.
I like being vindictive.
Well, there you are.
Cool.
But the right got up in arms over the fact that the left didn't have good things to say about Jerry Falwell in passing. Of course, what I'm waiting for is when Michael Moore dies, what the right will have to say about him. I guarantee you they won't be very charitable.
Probably not.
But what they'll say is, oh, well, Michael Moore was no Jerry Falwell. And the reason they have this problem...
Well, it's true, they both have different names.
Exactly. But they have this problem in large part because when you're a 20%er on the right, the people at the other extreme seem like whack jobs. They're so far out from where your point of view is. And vice versa. It works the other way. The people on the far left think that the people on the far right are nut jobs because they just can't possibly relate to their views. As someone who is in that 60% in the center, my listeners know I'm left of center, but I'm not a 20%er, I can see the blind spots that both sides have. And what I always argue to you folks out there is that I have more in common with those of you who are right of center, but not 20%ers, that is, you're just to the right of center, but reasonable people. I have more in common with you than I do with the people on the far left, who a lot of people say, well, you're liberal, so therefore you agree with the people on the far left. No, I agree with the moderates in the center. And if you're left of center or right of center, or you're Republican or Democrat, as long as you're moderate about things, we can probably see eye to eye on an awful lot more issues than we would disagree on.
You'd be a perfect politician.
Well, I don't know about that, because
I'd vote for you.
Huey Long said, thank you, and I like to think this can work.
I was actually being sarcastic.
Oh, well, then the heck with you.
Yeah.
But I think it was it Huey Long that said it?
Sure.
It gets attributed nowadays to Jim Hightower, the pundit, I guess they call him, from Texas.
They do.
The argument or the statement he made was, the reason why there shouldn't be moderates in politics, or there aren't moderates in politics, is that the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow stripes and dead armadillos.
I don't get it.
If you've ever traveled the roads of Texas, the roadkill down there tends to be armadillos.
Cool.
But if you've seen roadkill up here, it's the same principle. Roadkills, road animals trying to...
I see a lot of squirrels.
Yeah, rodents trying to cross the road, gets flattened, and that's the argument, is that it's a mistake to be in the middle of the road, you will get flattened, or else you're yellow.
Yellow.
That's the thing about the yellow stripes. He could have said
yellow.
He could have said not in the South. He could have said white stripes, right? Of course, Huey didn't know the band at the time. Hmm. But he could have said white stripes, but he chose yellow stripes. So I've always interpreted that to mean you're chicken if you're in the center. And this is the Rush Limbaugh school of moderation. Rush Limbaugh says there's no such thing as a moderate. A moderate is just someone who hasn't made up their mind.
Oh, that's lovely.
Well, some would say that. My answer to El Rushbo is this. No, we've made up our mind, and we've chosen sanity.
Hmm. That's a great quote.
You may quote me on
that. Huey Long?
No, Andy Finn.
Oh. Well, that's not so great.
So, Huey Long was a senator from way back when, maybe the 50s, 40s, and 50s.
Well, I knew that.
I know you did. I'm telling the rest of the people in the audience who might not have.
Okay.
But I do believe that moderates need to take this country back. We need to take the airwaves back. Because what's happened is we let the 20 percenters on the air. I mean, tune in Fox News as an example. And the people they bring on to talk about things are Laura Ingraham, Michelle Malkin, Ann Coulter, these right-wing rabid 20%. They're not just 20 percenters. They're 5 percenters and 1 percenters. That is, they're out at the far extremes. And what happens is they have no tolerance of the other side. They assume the other side is not just wrong, and it's so clear you not even any point in talking about it, but that the other side are loony. They are lunatics. Bill O'Reilly, the same thing. He talks about how loony the left is. He thinks that the Michael Moores of the world, the people on Air America, the bloggers, Media Matters, who just quote his words back to people and show what he says on the air, he calls them, you know, a left-wing hit squad. What happens is when you're a 20 percenter, you cannot see the perspective of the other side. You're literally trapped in your own perspective. And that's why the 60% of us in the middle, 30% right of center, 30% left of center, need to band together and say, in the words of George H.W. Bush, this will not stand. And put some of these people in their place.
This will not stand.
Yes, that's what he said about Saddam's invasion of Iraq in 1990.
Wow.
And he didn't let it stand. He went in there with Operation Desert Shield. Then he went in there with Operation Desert Storm. And he kicked...
This will not stand.
And he kicked some Saddam butt.
Saddam butt? Or Saddam butt?
Well, he made it a point to mispronounce his name. That's the argument. They were cagey,
yes,
and claimed he did it on purpose. I don't know why they haven't claimed that with his son. Maybe because he mispronounces almost everything.
It's funny.
It seems to be. In any case, so with Jerry Falwell's death, what's interesting is to listen to the people on the far right and the far left argue past each other about issues.
Indeed.
And I don't have to say too much more about Jerry. I'm not going to recount all the things he said that were hurtful or hateful. But, you know, he seemed to think for many years he thought he knew God's will, because he would say, well, the reason God did this is X. And then he would pick his favorite thing he liked to complain about and say that was the reason. So he frequently blamed gays for things, and most famously blamed 9/11, God's vengeance. He said God has lifted the curtain or something like this and allowed our enemies to harm us because of secularism, because of gays, because of the women's movement, because of now and the ACLU and anything liberal. So he backed off that. He did apologize for that, and then he said, no, God doesn't bring harm on us for, you know, any particular thing people do, which is right, I believe.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised. I'm glad he could see it, but still, the words did escape his mouth first.
True that.
In any case, let's talk for a minute about the war czar. No, I don't want to talk about the war czar.
Neither do I.
Well, good. I'm glad we're in agreement here. Let's talk
about Paris Hilton.
No, I don't. I'm definitely not going to talk about Paris Hilton. So let's just talk for a minute about Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz has agreed to resign. No matter what you think of the situation, this is not primarily about his girlfriend, Risa, whatever her name is.
Risa.
So he got her a sweetheart deal, and he arranged it himself. he tried to go to the ethics committee as his defense, and et cetera. And then they blamed him. The whole bank blamed him for not living up to the standards he set, which was he was on a push to kill corruption.
Yeah.
But the real story behind Paul Wolfowitz, for those of you who are still saying he was mistreated, is this. He went into this organization, and he tried to bully it. And you cannot go into an organization and expect it, just because you've been named president, expect to have it turn on a dime and do what you want.
No, you can't.
You have to elicit cooperation in any organization. And it's fine that Wolfowitz thought it was on the wrong course and these people needed to shape up. It doesn't work that way. You're going to be president for a few years. The people who are there for a whole career, 20, 40 years, are going to be there long after you're gone. And frankly, they're the experts. Wolfowitz had no particular expertise in banking and these large overseas loans development projects, all of that stuff. And yet he comes in with his staff members like a bull in a china shop and tries to force the organization to change. That's not how you effect organizational change. In fact, his reputation from people that know him was that very clearly he wasn't the kind of person that could be expected to finesse something and gain cooperation. He is much more of a bull in a china shop. So people saw this coming. Friends of his expected this to end badly. So those of you who are conservatives or Republicans and support Wolfowitz and think the bank needed to change and these people are corrupt or they are naive and they shouldn't be doing business the way they're doing it and they're wasting money and they get paid too much, some of that may be true. But Wolfowitz went in and tried to run roughshod over an organization that's been in place for decades. And it almost cost the United States the right to name the World Bank president. Every time the vacancy opens up, we get to name, the president of the United States gets to name the World Bank president.
Yes, we do.
And in return, the Europeans get to name the president of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. Not to be confused with the IMF of the Mission Impossible movies.
I love those movies.
The Impossible Mission Forces, as they stamp on those little folders.
Tom Cruise is great.
Different IMF. Tom Cruise was in town this weekend.
Really? I missed him?
If you were riding your bike or walking along the canal...
I was.
No, you weren't.
No, I wasn't.
You might have seen Tom Cruise because he was there with Katie.
Tomcat
was there, Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise, and they were biking with Dan Snyder, of all people... president of the Redskins, owner of the Redskins, because Snyder has agreed to bankroll some of Cruise's future movies, and so they were in town talking business.
Wow.
For what that's worth. Anyway, I'm not going to say a
basket.
Lot about... What's that?
Was Little Baby Siri in the basket?
No, I didn't mention anything about Little Baby Siri, but possible that she was in town too, but at the nannies.
Great.
In any case, I'm going to leave the Wolfowitz thing here. We don't need to beat this dead horse. He will be gone at the end of June. He's staying around, but he promises he's going to collect his salary, but he promises not to actually do anything because they're afraid he would actually start firing people that stood up to him or do something, and he's not going to try and do that. Actually, the reason he's staying is he's not trying to pocket extra money. The Bush administration is leaving him there because if he goes, then the bank will want to name an interim president, and then that person might be entrenched and the Bush administration might not get to name the next president. So that's why they're doing what they're doing. But enough about Wolfowitz. That era is over. One more Bush administration bull in the china shop guy has been put out to pasture in favor, hopefully, of somebody who knows how to get along with people.